This is the model under which the family still operates. For local listeners in the Finger Lakes, I would like to invite you to attend an event. I am honored to have been asked to lead a discussion on the gift economy on March 7th at the Peace Potluck in Perry City. This is quite a challenge for me, as I have never led a discussion on this, which is quite a different thing from broadcasting about it. So please come if you'd like to join the discussion. The Peace Potluck will be on Saturday, March 7th, beginning with dinner at 5:30, eating the food we've brought to share. It's a potluck, after all, another example of the gift economy. Then we'll discuss from 7 to 9. The Perry City Meeting House is on Route 227, just north of the intersection at Perry City Road. There's a map at perrycityfriends.org. Now we return to capitalism and its discontents.
Last month, Latvia, Lithuania, and Bulgaria were rocked by riots, fueled by economic contraction. Yet unlike most of their wealthy European counterparts, which have resources to stimulate their economies and bail out their banks, the nations of Eastern Europe are broke. Last autumn, Hungary's economy hovered on the brink of collapse, averted only by a $25.1 billion International Monetary Fund-led bailout. Ramsey Canan speaks with geographer Salvatore Engel Di Mauro about the situation in Hungary.
Several months ago, Hungary became the first European Union country to be bailed out by the International Monetary Fund, so-called IMF. What led to the economic crisis in Hungary?
There are quite a few factors involved. Some of them have to do with the present conjuncture. The financial crisis in general, started really in the United States, but it's really also part of a long-term dynamics. So the first one, the immediate one, is related to the fact that Hungary over the past two or three decades is almost completely overrun with multinationals. Transnationals basically control the bulk of export, and that comprises something like 60 to 70% of GDP. So if anything goes wrong with multinational corporations, particularly banks, and there's only one Hungarian-owned national bank left since the changes in the early 90s. The rest are basically German, Austrian, Italian, etc. So if anything goes wrong with those banks, it's immediately felt in the Hungarian economy. And since the exports have become such a large chunk of GDP, much more than earlier times or earlier decades, any redirection of capital away from the country, from multinational corporations, sends the entire economy into a tailspin, which it did, to the point where the government ran out of money. It was due to pay up its debt, and its debt service, incidentally, has risen to about 20% of GDP. So that's a very huge chunk of the economy that goes to service debts. So when they became due, and the government saw that there was no sort of ready source of money readily available, then basically was either bankruptcy or being bailed out. And of course, now that it's part of the European Union, and then so many transnational corporations would also suffer the consequences of that, to some extent anyway.
So it was there was a balance of payments crisis then last fall?
Yes, exactly.
For the last couple of decades, so since the fall of so-called communism in Hungary, Hungary embraced the free market.
Well, Hungary was actually inducted into the International Monetary Fund. 1982, in fact, actually Romania.
So this is while
it was
still behind the so-called Iron Curtain.
Well, yes, the Iron Curtain was not exactly made of iron in those days, as much as it was. People were led to believe. Structurally, Hungary has been heavily dependent on Western capital for decades before the fall of that dictatorial regime. And it became so heavily indebted over time that the structural adjustment programs have been imposed several times in Hungary before, even the 1990s, even while it was under the USSR's orbit. but it wasn't really economically under the USSR's orbit. It was politically, militarily. And so there was what fantastic sociologist by the name of Jozef Burdett put it. It was in a dual dependency. Now it's come completely under the umbrella of Western Europe through the European Union and NATO, and so beyond just Western Europe, but also the U.S. So as a result of that dependency, it's become drawn much more to the, I suppose, to the economic vagaries, if you will, of North America and Western Europe. And so this is one of the, I guess, the consequences of that dependence.
Well, as you said, the IMF has been involved in Hungary's finances, for better or worse now, for 30-something years.
Mm-hmm.
The current bailout, so to speak, which is funded, as you said, by not only the IMF but members of the European Union and several European banks. What were the terms of this current injection of cash?
Yeah, the terms are not too dissimilar from the one that occurred earlier in 1995, when the socialists were in power, the Socialist Party, that is. And now we have the Socialist Party in power again, and we have a similar similar kind of result. It's going to be cuts in health care. That's what's being demanded, basically.
As a terms of the loan?
Yeah. Cuts in state provisions, so mostly welfare. Just heard the Hungarian news, and they were saying that they're going to make sure that the police force have enough money for, you know, after this package that has been introduced. By the way, this is also the source of a rift, a political rift between the ruling coalition that has led to their split. So now we have a minority government that is ruling until the next elections, which will be in 2010. And basically, it's about healthcare, and so actually, these austerity measures are causing quite a political struggle to become even more internecine than usual within Hungary. But basically, these are the kind of austerity policies that are supposed to be put into place. You cut down the state budget, and that, of course, translates as usual. Not into cutting, for example, the payments for military activities or for NATO membership. So that's never questioned, of course. But it's going to be pensions. It's going to be the introduction of new taxes. In fact, Gyurcsány, the current prime minister, was trying to introduce sales taxes. So basically, again, socializing the costs even more beyond sort of the cuts on welfare, which will make it even harder for a lot of Hungarians who are not doing too well to be able to even afford the loans they have to pay back for the mortgages, which is also part of what's going on in Hungary, and part of the reason for the bailout as well is that there's also the possibility of a collapse in the housing market there too, which would have other banks being strapped for cash and go perhaps in the way that a lot of banks have in the US in terms of mortgage repayments.
Well, the bailout itself is huge. It's one of the biggest IMF loans ever.
$25 billion, yeah.
Wow. So you're suggesting that already that this bailout and its attendant austerity measures, you're suggesting it's not working?
No. It's rather... Well, you know, the last IMF imposed austerity measures bore their fruit, I guess, now, in which you've got a more casualized workforce that is being paid less with less benefits. And in 1995, there were quite a few protests about the austerity measures imposed back then. But they were met with the arguments such as, you know, we have to tighten belts and the future will be brighter thereby and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, we can see how bright the future became. This is why things are becoming much less stable, I mean, socially speaking, in Hungary these days. And there are a lot of tensions that have been building up for the past decade.
But even in economic terms, industrial output is at its lowest for 16 years, I believe.
Yeah, so exactly. And you can see how this is yet another example. The IMF model is made to make countries fail. So what is the point of doing all this I presume that the point is to make them even more dependent on a capitalist class that's concentrated in the wealthiest countries. If you want to make sure that you get workforce all over the world to produce things so that most of that capital is concentrated into very few hands, that's one way of doing it. Of course, there are also aspects of the IMF that are changing because the Chinese banks want to have more of a say and more of the part of the world's loot that is being had through IMF policies. But basically, it's like denying, you know, most Hungarians the kind of welfare that they've been used to for generations, and been cutting those welfare provisions more and more since the early 90s, and making them work more, and so that the surplus accumulated can be even more for mostly multinationals, because they control, as I said before, like between 60% and 70% of GDP, because basically that's the entire export sector is under multinational hands.
And that was Salvatore Engel Di Mauro, who teaches geography at SUNY New Paltz and whose work focuses on Hungary, speaking with Ramsey Canan. You're listening to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a Pacifica special five-part series on the global economic meltdown. I'm Sasha Lilly. More than 1 in 10 Americans are currently on food stamps, about 31 million people, according to the Department of Agriculture. Yet while record numbers are relying on the program to keep from going hungry, and while employers are eliminating jobs at the highest rate since 1974, federal welfare aid is not increasing. Nationwide, the number of people drawing on cash assistance has reached a 40-year low. Eric Klein examines today's social safety net.
Frances Fox Piven is a faculty member at the Graduate School of the City University of New York, teaching political science and sociology. She writes about social movements in the U.S., social welfare policy, and electoral politics.
The American social welfare system, the safety net people call it, really developed in two big spurts.
Those spurts were in the 1930s, Piven says, during the New Deal, and then in the mid-1960s to the mid-70s, when the New Deal programs were expanded and new programs like Medicare and Medicaid were added. Both spurts, Piven says, were backed by social movements and agitation. Piven thinks that the peak period of the American welfare state came in the early 1970s.
After that period, the movements that had given rise to the programs, that had forced the creation of the programs in the 1930s and again in the 1960s, those movements subsided.
Rising up to take their place, as it were other groups, particularly business groups, which began to mobilize to roll back the American safety net, Piven says, because it represented a floor for the American worker that threatened profits. Piven says that the welfare state was in decline for three decades, when in the 1990s it was dealt a very serious blow under the guise of welfare reform, pushed by a Republican Congress and signed by President Clinton, who gained political capital in the process.
Clinton rode the thing, and he signed the bill. And so now, when we confront a recession that may well turn into a second Great Depression, There really is no cash assistance program for the very poorest people who are likely to be hurt the hardest by this economic downturn.
Some women have come up against barriers to accessing that welfare system. Some women have come up against state grants that are taken away from them when they have additional children.
Anisha Desai is the executive director of the Women of Color Resource Center, an Oakland, California-based nonprofit that does political education and leadership work with low-income women. The center works largely with women who depend, such as it is, on the social safety net. Desai says that the conclusion of the welfare reform debate in the 1990s imposed an unnatural silence.
For most of the women that we work with, the issue is certainly not done, and they're receiving state aid had nothing to do with their reticence to get a job, their lack of impetus to get a job, and everything to do with the economic situation that they were in and the necessity of receiving that aid to sustain their families.
Tsai says that the women she works with are also facing an uphill struggle, keeping the benefits they have, and women in Oakland are not alone in that regard. A New York Times analysis of New State data shows that despite increasing unemployment during this economic crisis, 18 states have cut their welfare rolls this last year. And nationally, the number of people receiving cash assistance remained at or near the lowest in more than four decades. Desai of the Women of Color Resource Center says that the people she works with have been disproportionately impacted by these hard times.
There is data that supports the fact that, women of color, people of color, particularly blacks and Latinos, have been in a kind of a repeated recession for 5 years, which constitutes a depression.
That data comes from a report by the United for a Fair Economy called State of the Dream 2009, The Silent Depression. Frances Fox Piven thinks that despite all this troubling news, it is possible for a new wave of pressure to reverse the decline of the social safety net.
Well, I think that the signs are good, not simply or not even mainly because Barack Obama is going to try to do something about poverty in the United States left to himself, but because he is vulnerable to a very different constituency than the constituencies to which Republican leaders responded. He knows that, too. He knows that he has to be responsive to the young and to minorities and to working people and to the poor. But he won't do it by himself. Left to himself, he'll sign a compromise stimulus package that enlarges tax cuts for the more affluent at the expense of expanding Medicaid for the poor and unemployment insurance for the poor. But if people protest, if they take to the streets, if they make trouble for him, if they demand that he honor his promises of hope and change, then maybe he'll be a great president.
For Capitalism and Its Discontents, I'm Eric Klein.
In a dumpster and eat from a garbage can. There used to be jobs, now there's a food bank man. I never met anybody who wanted nothing. I never met anybody who wanted to be a victim. I never met anybody who wanted to be dead, but I sure know a lot of things. So
while media in the U.S. has focused on the financial calamity unfolding in the rich countries of the North, many in the Global South argue that they've been in crisis for the past quarter century. I spoke with economist Patrick Bond, director of the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, and asked him about the roots of the crisis as he sees it.
That's a great question because we do have a division amongst political economists, some who would trace it just to the bubble emerging in 2007 and then bursting, starting with subprime mortgages, then moving through some of the other financial derivatives and the whole panic because bankers don't know the value of each other's assets, so they stop trading. So it has been a short-term phenomenon. There are many of us, on the other hand, who think that the crisis tendencies can be traced to the early 1970s. And the reason for going back quite so far is that we want to root the problems that are at the surface level in the financial sector in the deeper-rooted problems in the productive sector, where effectively too much was produced. And so subsequently, over the past 3.5 decades, a variety of little fixes were employed to deal with that, and those fixes themselves generated ever deeper crisis tendencies. So by that I mean, if the rate of profit falls because you've produced too much, too many goods, and you can't really realize the profits, you start playing with things like the credit system, the real estate markets, stock markets, and they become new sources of short-term ephemeral profits. And it's there where, for example, General Motors or Ford moved a huge amount of their assets into things like General Motors Acceptance Corporation to become the biggest mortgage bond, the mortgage holder, and then the Ford became, through Nationwide, huge savings and loan operator in the late 80s, and GE became a big financial services company. And that's really the trajectory of a lot of capital that moves out of productive activity and into speculative financial parasitical activity by the 1990s, bubbling up big crashes in the late 90s and periodically in the stock market 2000 and in the real estate market from 2007. But again, it's a deep-rooted process. It happens in capitalism every 60, 70 years. It's part of an accumulation cycle. I think that's a more convincing argument because it really has the deep-rooted tendencies, not just the surface forms.
So you were speaking about fixes that capital attempts in order to offset crisis. In the prolonging of this crisis, did these fixes take a geographic or spatial form?
Well, geography is really always a tool of capital to reinvent itself. The spatial fix, the geographical movement of this over-accumulated capital, the over-productive and now financial capital, really went into the third world after the big OPEC cartel centralized so-called petrodollars, and then they were
in the early 1970s.
Yeah, they really took off from about 73, and then the dictators just, you know, they kind of borrowed to buy guns to keep their people down, which gave them a higher credit rating, which allowed them to borrow more to buy more guns and keep their people down as a sort of a vicious cycle. And, of course, lots of prestige projects or white elephants and lots of corruption and capital flight. Eventually, that with Paul Volcker, many listeners know him because Barack Obama's turned to him for crucial advice in recent months. But Paul Volcker was the chair of the Federal Reserve in 1979, and he tripled the interest rate. And so that particular fix came to an end. The geographical float of capital then quickly reversed because the third world countries, Mexico starting off in 1982, really crashing. Indeed, even before that, Poland, with the beginning of the real crash of the Eastern Bloc countries. That reflected that the interest rate tripled, and the third world debt crisis was a source then of real super exploitation. As third world countries just had to produce more exports, end their industrial policies, cut their social wage to the bare minimum, and IMF riots began. And finally, the dictators had to leave. The dictators left the debt to the Democrats, as the saying went. And you began to see some transitions to democracy, but of a low-intensity sort. Walden Bellows got that phrase, a low-intensity democracy. And that's the idea that then the IMF World Bank really was running most of the third world in the 1980s and 90s because of the debt that gave them the power. As they took over loans that the New York and Frankfurt and London banks, the Tokyo banks had made, and to pay off the interest on that money, the third world dictators and then the Democrats had to, from Latin America, from East Asia, from Africa, as gradual democracy was established in many of the countries, they didn't really have the power to change anything because neoliberal policies were imposed because of the power of debt. So the spatial fix, that geographical strategy of moving money into the third world as a way to find a quick rate of return when the North was in a recession in the 70s, in turn amplified the crisis. It became a third world debt crisis. And then we saw the wages and the development prospects for Latin America, Africa, and some of Asia just ruined in the 80s. And, of course, a few countries in East Asia had the Asian miracle countries were able to prosper because they'd moved a little bit more quickly out of raw materials and minerals and cash crops and into production, and uneven development across the world meant that they were a cheaper location as another geographical fix, namely the productive capacity of the U.S. shifting out into East Asia, first in maquiladoras in Mexico and then into cheaper locations even than that in China eventually. And of course, that meant even more overproductive capacity emerged and the contradiction just got worse.
Well, where does South Africa fit in the trajectory that you've just been laying out? Obviously, listeners know that in the early 90s, the ANC came to power, spelling the end of apartheid. What happened there in the 1990s can give us a sense of how South Africa now is being affected by this crisis.
Well, in fact, Sasha, after being a Pacifica reporter and 1989. I moved to South Africa in 1990 and then found that there was a very explicit mirroring of the processes at the world scale here, because apartheid really wasn't really ended. It was sort of transformed from racial to class apartheid, and inequality, in fact, got much worse after 1994. I say that as someone who worked twice in Nelson Mandela's office doing policy drafting in the mid-1990s, and unfortunately the power relations were that a few elites got control and as white business and the old white Afrikaner government retreated from formal state power. What they demanded in return for giving up the state was liberalizing. So all the richest people and all the biggest companies between 1994 and about 2000 were able to basically get all their money out of the country. They sort of looted the country because of the ideology of the free market. And so we had a quite intense experience of neoliberal free market reforms, privatization, shrinkage of state projects in a variety of ways, and even things at a very microscopic level that are crucial to people, like the water that they drink. You know, it was privatized in many cities or commercialized, and in a city like Johannesburg, the biggest contract where a big French company, Suez, was running the water, quite a number of revolts occurred in Soweto, and there was a bit of resistance. So we've seen a bit of a fight back, and indeed, just last September, the most neoliberal major politician, the president, Thabo Mbeki, was kind of overthrown in a palace coup, largely because we've seen the huge rise in social protest and grievances from the trade unions and the Communist Party. So they did have a little bit of power to throw out Thabo Mbeki, the neoliberal president. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean that they had power to actually change policies, and they haven't really changed. So I think what we can learn from the South African experience is that, as the old social theorist Karl Polanyi put it, a kind of double movement. The market replaced racism as a source of exploitation. Rich people and the biggest companies like Anglo-American and De Beers and Old Mutual and what's called SAB Miller, South African Breweries, owns Miller Beer. They ran away to London for their financial headquarters, and they take huge profits and dividends out of the country, leaving a large deficit on the current account. And all of that has left this country very vulnerable. We've actually had five major crashes of the currency since 1995. The first was when there was a rumor Nelson Mandela was sick in 1996, and the big financial players just ran away in fear. So we've seen extreme vulnerability and neoliberal policies, and the finance minister, Trevor Manuel, who Time magazine very recently suggested might be the new global finance minister if in April Gordon Brown at the G20 meeting in London is able to put together a new kind of Bretton Woods sort of project, and Trevor Manuel becomes a legitimizer. And regrettably, the South African revolution to get rid of exploitation faltered and was truncated, and really just put a new group of elites into power. And for most people, inequality has gotten worse. Unemployment has doubled. It's a kind of extreme version of this uneven development that's beset the world. And although the financial crisis hasn't hit quite so hard yet, I think it will, because our real estate bubble is about three times bigger relatively than even the United States, and the vulnerability on the international side is quite extreme. So we're looking for a rough ride, but we have a very, very strong working class, very class conscious, and very, very powerful social movements. Some of them even managed to get antiretroviral medicines, AIDS medicines, in spite of the big pressures against that from big pharmaceutical companies, the Clinton, Gore, Bush administrations, and the Mbeki government. And so that's one of our great victories, is to say that when capital moves too quickly into daily life, into, say, medicines for AIDS, 6 million people here are HIV positive. About 1 million need the medicines right now. And we've been able to get 700,000 people onto the medicines because of protest against these big companies and against the government. So there's both despair and a tragedy on the one hand that our revolution didn't move that fast, but extraordinary hope that there are a lot of people who didn't give up fighting.
Well, you say that the crisis hasn't yet hit South Africa fully. I mean, this current crisis, of course. How open is South Africa's economy, and are there any impediments to the flow of capital that South Africa has that, say, other countries may not?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, because, you know, the initial crash of many of the, you know, the big investment banks in September, October, AIG, the big U.S. Insurance company, the big commercial banks like Citi, all of that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all of that happening in September, October, did leave a very big chunk of South Africa exposed, and about a quarter of the value of the currency and a quarter of the stock market just was evaporated in a couple of weeks. So certainly there was a kind of burst initially. But we've unfortunately seen so much of the capital flight, 25 separate liberalizations or relaxations of exchange controls since 1995, that I fear quite a lot more is still to come. However, of interest is that it could have been much worse, and there are many countries that had a bigger hit than that sort of 25%. And the reason that many people, including conservatives and neoliberals, will concede that South Africa hasn't yet gone as far as I suspect it will, is because there is a little bit of friction because of exchange controls, which keep residents' money still in the country up to about a million rand or $100,000. Beyond that, it's a little bit harder to take people's money out. The big problem, of course, the big companies, the really rich and powerful people in the country, have been able to take their money overseas.
This is Capitalism and Its Discontents on Pacifica Radio. We'll return to our interview with South Africa-based scholar Patrick Bond about the origins and consequences of the economic slump for those in the Global South after this music break. Patrick, you've been talking about neoliberalism, which of course is the ideology and agenda of deregulation, economic liberalization, privatization, cutting away the social safety net, and an ideology that, at least in theory, is about the government being out of the equation, although an argument could be made that actually the state intervenes in all sorts of ways to prop up markets. But right now we're seeing massive government intervention in rich countries in the United States to try and shore up the financial system. Does this spell an end to neoliberalism, or is that too optimistic a hope?
It is. And dear friends and extraordinary analysts, say Walden Bellow, for example, has argued that neoliberalism is last century's ideology, and those of us who raise it are fighting last century's battles. I think that's incorrect because, frankly, while the North may posture towards Keynesianism, we're still yet to see whether Barack Obama goes through with a major public works spending project. But in the South, and I can speak for what I've seen in the International Monetary Fund reports on South Africa, about 800 pages were released there on the IMF website last October, and the particularly powerful one about the, it's called the Article 4 consultation, that really gives the key advice to the South African government was precisely, as you said, Sasha, that is the old Washington consensus menu to privatize, to liberalize, to cut government spending and to raise the interest rate, and to cut back on the real wage, because there's a fear that the wage increases will push inflation. If you take those kind of five basic policy measures that come from Washington, it's just obvious that at the very same time, that was October 22nd, that Dominic Strauss-Kahn was babbling about how we need much more public spending, a Keynesian project to get out of the world recession. That was inclement, Dominic Strauss-Kahn being the managing director of IMF. His very staff were parachuting into South Africa or at the very same time to Seychelles and to many other countries and just saying the opposite and telling the countries, because South Africa isn't really in debt to the IMF and doesn't sort of take orders, but there are plenty of African countries that do and will have to do ongoing neoliberalism. I also think that Barack Obama will be under the kind of pressure to commercialize and liberalize. Let me just take one example, Sasha, which is where Barack Obama finally addresses the climate. Unfortunately, he's got a whole group of advisors, amongst whom Larry Summers, the former Harvard president kicked out for sexism. He was a former World Bank chief economist, where he had a very racist comment that the, quote, economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. African countries are vastly underpolluted. Those are direct quotes from Larry Summers, who's head of the big economic council, and of course the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, being a sort of neoliberal and a deal maker, crony capitalist, a deregulator, and Austin Goolsbee, another top advisor from the University of Chicago, advising Barack Obama during the campaign, and he's been a strong advocate of financial deregulation. These are maniacs, really, Sasha, and when I think of the ways in which they would address the climate, I would, for example, raise carbon trading as a very dangerous mechanism, the so-called cap-and-trade strategy to put a price on the air, and the right to pollute becomes codified and sold. And we have a third world version of it, the clean development mechanism, in which major projects are started, which are very destructive when you look at them in more detail. These projects of trying to put a price on everything, and when you have a market problem, say pollution and greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming and climate change, well, then you need a market solution. That ideology, that free market ideology, really still pervades the Obama administration on the most crucial issue for all of us and our descendants, climate change. And regrettably, Barack Obama has got these advisors and thinks that the route to solving climate crisis is privatization of the air, carbon trading. That's the kind of neoliberalism that I think we'll see more of. We need a lot more sophistication and militancy to combat it.
What else do you think is in the offing in terms of how elites in the global north and the global south will handle this crisis? Because clearly it is, however they might manage it to their benefit, it is a crisis, I think one could argue, of the system itself, and that it is hard for them to control. So it means obviously great losses for them. How do you think they will respond to that, both economically and politically?
There are a few chances they have this year, but the last two opportunities, the Davos World Economic Forum in Switzerland at the end of January, and the G20 meeting, that's the group of 20 largest financial economies, that was held in Washington in November, an IMF meeting just before that in October. Those opportunities show that there's no plan. And in fact, you could even argue that the best left-leaning thinkers in the world, for example, in economics, Joseph Stiglitz, the former World Bank chief economist who then won the Nobel Prize and was fired from the World Bank in 1999 by Larry Summers via the World Bank president James Wolfensohn for attacking the Washington consensus, even with the configuration in the United Nations where Miguel de Soto, the former Nicaraguan Sandinista foreign minister, is the president of the General Assembly. He hired as a special advisor men like Noam Chomsky or the great water warrior Maude Barlow as special advisors, another being François Houtard, a Belgian Marxist, and Joseph Stiglitz to run this commission. Unfortunately, in Doha at the end of November, that financing for development and that whole kind of commission to put a major analysis together they issued at the beginning of January showed, again, no imagination, no grand vision, and no power, no money to actually solve the problem. So the global elite are paralyzed. They had a fairly coherent and surprisingly coherent agenda, Sasha, that fused neoliberalism, free markets, with neoconservatism, the Bush imperialist agenda. I didn't think that could hold together as well as it did in the 2000s, and then it's, of course, just come apart under the pressure of the meltdown of finance and the U.S.'s major losses in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they haven't got anything to replace it. Walden Bellow suggests that the next big project is going to be a global social democracy of the sort that Stiglitz or Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, Princeton professor, has suggested, but I don't think so. I'm not finding any evidence at the moment that there will be coherence amongst the elites. Here's where we'll be able to look for some evidence in the next few months in the G20 meeting in April in London. There'll be major protests starting April 1 around the climate and April 2. That's when that meeting starts in London. And then at the G8 meeting, they're holding it off the coast of Italy. I think the last time they held it in Italy, in Genoa, hundreds of thousands got out to protest and made a spectacle of that. And then I think the IMF meeting in Washington in September, and finally Copenhagen for the climate meeting in December. We'll have to probably wait to see if any kind of global capitalist elite consciousness emerges. Instead, I see some friction and fractions, the fractions being the Chinese capitalists, as well as even the Russians and a few other malcontents from fairly aggressive capitalist countries that aren't in the top circuitry. And then, of course, we have the fracturing that means the left governments of Latin America, and especially Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and Paraguay, and even at the World Social Forum recently, the Brazilian President Lula joined that group of four. They may generate a multipolar challenge by setting up new institutions like the Bank of the South and the Bolivarian trade alternative to the free trade area of the Americas. And these are the sorts of things that give us some hope that it's not just the social movements and labor and environmentalists who are fighting this from the base, but we might even see some sites of power in national capitals. Not really in Africa, and that may be where we see the worst damage being imposed upon the people who are already most vulnerable. Sasha, I think we'll see that in three ways. Africans have suffered from the rise of commodity prices because of the so-called resource curse, by which when, say, oil prices go up, you can go to the Niger Delta and see the enormous damage that's being done to people as the extraction goes on and leaves their communities and the people and especially the environment just demolished. Hence, many out there in the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta or NGOs that are very powerful and very, very serious progressive NGOs like the Environmental Rights Action in Port Harcourt have a sort of slogan, keep the oil in the soil. And they've been trying to keep that huge rise in commodity prices from 2002 to 2008 under control and keeping a large chunk of Niger Delta oil out of production. Unfortunately, most of Africa saw a large extractive process in minerals and to some extent in some of the cash crops. But that's come to an end, and so that would be the first major problem now faced with the crisis transmitting to Africa in the form of lower commodity prices. More and more countries got addicted to export-based growth. Major mining houses taking most of the profits, and now with the prices having crashed, a country like Zambia with all its copper just demolished. Something like 48 projects have been shut down, huge unemployment. I think a second problem, as the financing has shrunk for particularly the minerals inflows and a bit of the taxation that was able to be raised for that, now we're going to see the neoliberal project reascendant, and that'll mean tighter budgets and cuts in social programs and all and more privatization. And I think the third process is the gimmickry around global finance, where so many of the promises in 2005, I'm sure the listeners remember, make poverty history and the global call for action against poverty and lives aid and all of the sort of gimmicks to pretend that the North might give a few sense of debt relief and a bit more aid. None of that really panned out particularly, a little bit, but not substantively. And so as a result, I think a lot of faith has been lost in these processes.
Well, you argue, Patrick Bond, that resistance to debt, including refusing to pay off debts, should be a central dimension of people's response, movements' response to both what's led to this point and the crisis now. I wonder if you could talk about what you call non-reformist reform, strategies of reform on the left that don't end up locking movements into a limiting structure that keeps the demands within the structure of the existing system.
Well, yeah, indeed, the late French sociologist André Gortz had helped to distinguish between the kinds of reforms that amplify the system's power over people because they smooth the rough edges or they take a big movement of reform and basically take away its steam or co-opt it or distort the sense of reform and just give a surface version. And those reformist reforms, as André Gortz had put it, are what leaders and strategists and the sort of mass base of a social movement, a labor movement, an environmental movement have to guard against. And that's in contrast to non-reformist reforms, which operate against the internal logic of the system and continue to empower the movement rather than once the victory has occurred, they're disempowered, and that in turn give you a chance to win even more reforms further down the road. I think the Trotskyist tradition might term this the transitional demands, the demands that really will help a much deeper-rooted and revolutionary transformation occur. Now, if you take debt, it's quite tricky because there are so many processes that individualize and make out of ordinary consumers very wretched, indebted people who blame themselves. I mean, the farm suicides in India are just this one reflection of just how awful it is to be in debt and to not have any way out. But there are some good examples where people band together and fight the creditors. Let me give you a couple. One comes from here in South Africa, the bond boycott. A bond is a mortgage in the local lingo. And the bond phenomenon for black township borrowers only began in the mid-1980s. I think you remember before that there was a pass laws, which meant that black residents in South Africa were only so-called temporary sojourners in the cities. They were only really allowed to live in Soweto and Johannesburg or KwaMashu here in Durban because they were workers in a migrant labor system, and so they would have to go back to the rural areas or Bantustans. But by the 1980s, the pressures for reform and the very strong proletarian base in these townships meant that there was actually both political pressure and an economic incentive for housing developers and for bankers to go in, and they worked with the reformers in the government itself under even P.W. Botha, and they actually started to make loans by the mid-1980s. They made about 200,000, and by 1990, when neoliberalism began to hit hard and the interest rates went up by about 13% in real terms, then there was huge amounts of defaulting. And the longest depression hit this economy. And as a result, the most creative township organizers said, look, if we've got these badly built houses and they're too expensive as the interest rates are going up, we should get together. And if the sheriff comes with the banker and says, we're going to foreclose on you, Joe Kumalo, get out of the house now. Take your family out. We've got, you couldn't pay the bill, the bond payment, so we've got a new person to come in to take over this house. Well, the township street committee of a civic association would even go to the extent of burning that house down as a signal to the banker, don't even try this, don't come here, we can resist, we can force you back out. And these bond boycotts meant that everybody in an area stopped paying their bonds until the bank came to the negotiating table. And that occurred in over 100 places and was responsible for quite a lot of powerful resistance during the early 90s with the big housing crisis of that time. And if you think in 1994, December to be precise, when Mexico went through its bit of neoliberal hell when the interest rate went from 14 to 120% after the peso crash in December 1994, from January 95 through the subsequent 6 months, over a million people found themselves in such indebtedness that they formed El Barzón, the Spanish word for the yoke, oxen's yoke, to resist the banks. And they were, you know, small business people and small farmers and households. And they actually had a number of protests that included burning bankers and effigies and forcing the bankers to the table to renegotiate the terms of the loan. So those would be bottom-up kinds of strategies. I always like finding the solutions to macro problems in microscopic and household and community resistances that are quite insurgent and effective. I mean, as I mentioned before, the struggles to get free antiretroviral medicines come from wonderful resistance, or free water comes from, in Soweto, people reconnecting water pipes or electricity cables illegally. And those are the kinds of things that should inform us. I think when you go up to the meso level or to the national scale, those are the kind of pressures that in Nigeria until about 2005 got regular defaults, or in Ecuador just in January, were sufficiently strong from the social movements to get Rafael Correa, the president, to default on, I think it was about $13 billion of debt. And the basic slogan there from the Jubilee movement across the third world is don't owe won't pay and can't pay, indeed, in so many cases. And so defaulting on the third world debt, and especially doing so in a way as Rafael Correa did, to say, look, this is odious debt. The debt that was taken up by dictators is being expected, repayment from the Democrats. That's just not on. And indeed, if you really look at who owes what to whom, look at the ecological debt. I think Ecuador has a very strong case that especially Acción Ecología, the great Quito-based environmental group, has been making to keep the oil in the soil in the Yasuni Park in Ecuador. And that's partly because that Amazon region in which Yasuni is located is sucking up so much of the CO2 produced by the North, as the North takes up the environmental space for its pollution that it needs a sink for. Well, those of us in the global north, I sit here in South Africa, that's also one of the largest CO2 emitters. We really owe it to the rest of the world to start paying an ecological debt for all of the environmental space that's been taken. And in all of these ways, whether it's an argument or a national default or community-level resistance or households that are beginning to connect the dots and link the problems they're having with managing their budgets to the production system, to the ways in which consumers have gone out of control because of pressures to buy the latest commodity. Putting the dots together, I think, will generate a better critique of capitalism as a system. Unfortunately, just the materialism and consumerism still has a huge grip, and we haven't really seen an ebbing of the advertisements and the power of households over households of the marketing industry. So that's going to be have to be part of our critique. And the people who do that so well, Naomi Klein with her book No Logo, or Annie Leonard with the story of stuff.com, all of these critiques of consumerism, I think, have to be brought right on board. And the projects of people like Ralph Nader to get consumer protection, I hope, can be expanded and deepened into a post-consumer sort of project as well.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And that takes me to my final question, which is, you argue that we should be skeptical about multilateral fixes to this crisis, and that we should be thinking about the potential for states, for nation states, where you argue power actually lies, to set up barriers to capital flows, to be able to push policies which are more progressive, such as perhaps the ones that Hugo Chavez has introduced in Venezuela. I wanted to ask you about that, and also ask you if there's a danger with that when one focuses so much on the nation state within a context which obviously is still capitalist. Are there dangers there, both in terms of eroding internationalism and empowering those who you wouldn't want to empower?
Oh, sure. And the rise of proto-fascist movements or developments towards protectionism of crony capitalists would be very important warnings in many parts of the world, that if you allowed simple nationalist projects to bubble up right now, especially those that blame the problems merely on bankers, we've got some big problems. I still think, though, that if you eventually want to go to a global project to unify the world's peoples and find peace through multilateralism, you still have to recognize that the power balance at the moment is terribly adverse, and it just doesn't make sense to waste time and energy. So many of our colleagues in the NGO field, especially those in Washington, even a few in Berkeley, are wont to do, and that is to say that they try to get UN resolutions, or they try to find World Trade Organization reforms, or try to democratize the World Bank and IMF Board of Governors, or they're looking for the Kyoto Protocol to be slightly modified. And, if you go back, Sasha, I don't think since roughly 1996 with the Montreal Protocol, it gave us the chlorofluorocarbon ban so that we could do a little bit to save the ozone layer. There's a bit of a debate about whether that has been effective. We really haven't seen anything else since 1996, in my understanding, that represents genuine progress. Okay, a bit of a ban on toxics and persistent organic pollutants, toxic trade, but frankly, we haven't just got to the point, given the neoliberalism of the 90s, the neoconservatism of the 2000s, where the global elite want to solve the problems or have a coherent approach to do so in multilateral bodies. All of these efforts, from the UN Security Council expansion to IMF World Bank reforms and WTO agenda, the Doha agenda, or the climate talks, none of them are delivering. none of the global governance strategies are working. The global financial meltdown just could not be solved at the global scale. And there's going to be a free rider problem, as many countries are expecting, in a sense, to see the big Western bailouts underway, basically raise the global Keynesian scenario. But there isn't enough money out there to really do so. And probably the benefits will be passed on to the continuing import of consumer goods and hence to foreign countries. That's why I think so much protectionism is emerging in the U.S. Congress in this recovery stimulus package debate. And so as a result, you just have to look to where the existing power relations are such that you can impose capital controls or control imports and exports in a manner that would give you a chance to balance your economy or address the environmental issues. And those power relations only exist, as far as I can tell, where national states relate to the world economy and where they can put on controls over their things that go on inside the countries and on the borders. And regrettably, that means we really still have to follow, I think, Marx's old dictum, which is that each working class still has to first deal with its own national bourgeoisie. And it's in that sense that those who would argue for a big jump to kind of global governance or Tobin taxes to tax international financial transactions haven't yet shown us that they've got the power relations sorted out to do so. There's a bit of confusion at the moment with Barack Obama's president, with a lot of highfalutin rhetoric, and with even a Larry Summers saying he's Keynesian. There's going to be re-legitimization of the U.S. imperial project. We're very worried in Africa that the so-called AFRICOM, the Africa Command, will be coming back, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson in Liberia offering to host it, and that the illegitimacy of the Bush administration might be reversed, both through these securocrats led by Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates, but also by the econocrats like Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, Austin Goolsbee, and Paul Volcker. So that means from a place like Durban, South Africa, the best hope we have, especially for the big sites of crisis like the Middle East or the world financial system or the climate crisis, would be a rise in protest and surgical critiques and much tighter analysis from your listeners. For example, in recent days, we've seen our Durban dock workers take a lesson out of the San Francisco dock workers who stopped apartheid's shipping by refusing to unload South Africa ships. And our own Durban dock workers are doing their best to keep Israeli ships out of the biggest port in Africa here in Durban. And these are the kinds of things where internationalism and learning lessons and ratcheting up the militancy in a more coherent way, I hope, are going to be the agenda for coming days and weeks and months ahead.
And that was Patrick Bond, director of the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa and author of the book Looting Africa, published by Zed Press. For Capitalism and Its Discontents, I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to selections from a series, Capitalism and Its Discontents, produced for Pacifica Radio by Eric Klein, Eddie Yuen, Ramsey Kanan, and Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download a copy of this and all previous episodes at the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.